This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 28th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking, why do we love medical dramas? Everywhere in the world seems to love the drama of doctors, nurses, patients, procedure, blood and guts, trauma, love and loss. Casualty, ER, the flying doctors, for goodness sake. All of human life is there, it seems. We're going to inspect the appeal of the medical in fact and fiction by finding out how the fictional doctors of New Zealand's legendary Shortland Street hand out the right prescriptions, see how Cambodian TV uses hospital drama to teach people about disease, and invite the producers of the UK's hit Fly on the Wall show, 24 Hours in A&E, into the studio to tell us how drama is best made from reality.
When these people enter the A&E space or the emergency room space, you know, all the sort of preoccupations of daily life are stripped away, and what you're left with is actually just people focusing on what matters to them, and that can be quite revelatory for them as well.
So that's Why Do We Love Medical Dramas, all on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We'll start the show with real-life medical drama and the UK's hit show 24 Hours in A&E, which really lives up to its name. Cameras are wired into the accident and emergency room of a central London hospital to capture the ebb and flow of everything that goes on. And there's a lot, as you'd expect. Edited into a one-hour programme in which heroes emerge, tender moments are revealed, injury and tragedy rear their heads, splinters in fingers and amputated limbs share equal billing, and, charmingly, love conquers all. Hemo Forsyth and John Douglas are executive producer and series director for 24 Hours in A&E.
People wake up on a normal day and suddenly something happens that changes their lives completely.
Paediatric trauma call, 15 minutes.
A lot of really bad things happen to really good people, but you never think it's going to happen to you.
Stabbed five times, including chest, has got an arterial bleed from his leg.
High-speed RTC moped into a wall.
Jesus Christ, what happened?
Historically, if you like, people always really enjoyed television drama. 24 Hours in A&E was born off the back of that. You know, how could we make a factual programme in that space in an area that's very difficult to film in, for example? And, you know, here we are all those years later and all those episodes later. And, you know, the series has an enduring appeal that we're very proud of. And I just think from a storyteller's point of view, it's an amazing series to work on. Everything feels fresh. Every time you work with a new patient and their relatives, you get an amazing story. And that's what really makes the programmes. It's that human story behind all the medical stuff that goes on.
And John, technically, from the practical point of view, it'd be nice to know how you guys work with the hospital staff. And I suppose lots of people straight away would be thinking, you know, that we don't want nurses tripping over cameraman's cables and all the rest of it. So it's an old-fashioned concern. Nonetheless, it's one of those things. How does it practically work between you and the hospital?
So I think traditionally there had been documentaries made in medical spaces where there were camera operators and you'd have sound people with boom mics and researchers running around. The beauty of the way we make 24 Hours in A&E is it's using the fixed rig camera format. So there are cameras fixed to the walls that we put in right at the very beginning of the shoot. The last filming period we had was at St George's, and we had over 100 cameras across the whole department, and we operate those remotely from two galleries that are kind of separate from the hospital. So what that means is we can see what's going on. We do have a producer sort of on the floor making relationships with the hospital staff and with patients that come in. But the beauty of that is that there aren't any trailing cables. There aren't things that in normal sort of documentary filmmaking do get in the way. There's no sort of producer filter in between. What we're filming, I think, is real and, you know, is very honest because of that. You know, those cameras, we film 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for a 7-week period. And we're just continually getting material and filming whatever comes in the door. We've no idea what that's going to be, but those cameras are there and operated remotely and are able to pick up sort of whatever happens.
That's interesting that there's not, as you said, there's not even a producer filter between the staff, the patients and you guys. So that's the idea, presumably, that, you know, you've got a completely clean link between the drama or the material or the stuff that happens and what you edit and put together. Do you think part of the enduring appeal of the programme is the fact that there isn't a format to it, Haymo, that it because it is simply what happens and your edit on that's a secret of its endurance?
I completely agree. I mean, if you talk to medical practitioners about what they like on television that represents the work that they do, very many of them will say 24 Hours in A&E is a very fair representation of the job that they do. I mean, as John was saying, we just put the cameras there to just capture the inherent drama that's unfolding in that space. I mean, if you think for a minute about an emergency department and what's happening in it, you've got a space. When it's empty, it's expecting the unexpected to come in. You don't know how serious that's going to be, but it will come in. And then you've got a situation where it's about saving life or maintaining the quality of life, often against the clock. So that's a very good sort of medical part of the story. And then you have the patient themselves and their relatives who come in, or friends or whoever it might be. So that gives you the option to go to all of those sort of more human aspect sides of the story. And I think if you take all of that, we just allow that to unfold as it naturally would. And there are many elements there. That's what you'd get in a TV drama. So we're happy to just let that happen. I mean, obviously, subsequently, we build relationships with patients and the doctors, and we put interviews into the films that aren't recorded on the day. And that allows us to sort of, if you like, dial up certain elements of the story that appeal to us.
People's backstory gets told a little bit.
But if you just think about the filming on the day, we've no interest in going in and asking people to do that, or could you be a bit more concerned about this, or could you do that. You know, it's just obviously not the way we do it, because naturally that's happening anyway.
I mean, it's a well-known programme now. People know kind of maybe perhaps what is expected of them. But then as soon as they are in an emergency room, whether they're a patient or whether they're a loved one, then presumably all notions of acting go out the window, because you stop performing when you're in crisis. I presume that's what you see on the faces of all the people involved in the programme, right?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the way of filming, having the cameras on the walls, mean that people very, very quickly forget that there's any filming taking place at all. And the other thing about that hospital space is that I think there are two things that make the series so important. Is we've all got some experience of being in A&E, you know, some of us in more critical circumstances than others. So we all know what that space is like, and we all know, you know, what can unfold there. But I think the other sort of more important thing is that when you're in A&E, it is like a bubble, because it is a place where if you are with a loved one or where something has happened that's potentially very serious, you do contemplate your relationships, you contemplate how you feel about others. You might have very mundane conversations, but actually it's a bubble in which all of these sort of relationships can unfold. And as Haymo said, we're just there, you know, in a very privileged position, actually, to be able to capture that and then take that material away, keep a relationship with the people we've filmed, and ultimately sort of decide how to best sort of put programmes together. But I think that bubble is something that is crucial to the making of the series, because once you sort of step outside that, and we take great care, actually, that we don't really film beyond the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, once you step outside that, you start to lose the power of that. Absolutely, the power of those situations. So we make very kind of conscious decision that actually we stick very, very tightly to the sort of A&E space.
Ida's x-rays have revealed a shadow on the bone. It will need further investigation to determine the cause.
It's just an incidental finding, that because you never had an x-ray of your knee, that's why nobody knew about it.
No.
So it's just a general...
Couldn't be cancer or anything like that.
We are hoping it's nothing sinister going on there. But obviously, if they think that yes, it is, then we know what to do.
Yes,
nothing for you. You are here, exactly.
If I didn't have Ida, I wouldn't worry too much about myself. What would be? I couldn't imagine life without Ida.
I mean, what about the bubble that you are in as a production team? Because presumably that gets very close-knit very, very quickly as well. And you're not dealing with cynical material here. Presumably you're going on quite an emotional roller coaster. There's a lot of wonderfully tender moments. There's a lot of very sad moments and a lot of exciting moments actually in this programme. Presumably, Hamo, as much as you would like to dissociate yourself from it and be dispassionate, you can't help but be passionate with these stories, can you?
No, that's absolutely right. And all of the best films that we make will be born of the best relationships with those patients and trust and them opening up about something that's very personal to them and allowing us to tell that story. And if we get there, we're very lucky. It doesn't always happen. But all of the best episodes of 24 Hours in A&E have come from that sort of long-term relationship with those patients. You can't expect it to happen on the day. On the day, it's quite practical. It's about consents. It's about who you can film. It's about which doctors are consenting and which patients are. Yeah. And you sort of put that jigsaw together in order to be able to cover certain cases. But the real sort of getting to the heart of it, if you like, happens later. And we all do get very involved in those stories. And we have a specific team that joins us on the shoot and then in the edit that spends inordinate quantities of time with patients, getting to know them and discovering what stories they might be able to tell. But I think the interesting thing, just picking up on what John was saying, is that when these people enter the A&E space or the emergency room space, you know, all the sort of preoccupations of daily life are stripped away, and what you're left with is actually just people focusing on what matters to them. And that can be quite revelatory for them as well. And that's always part, I think, of the storytelling in this. It's really people talking about what matters to them, no matter where they're from.
Okay, this is not that bad.
Oh, it's not that bad. You're just a big pansy.
This is really tiny. You can just put a tiny plaster on it. It's 1 millimeter deep. So,
all that for a little tiny cut.
Obviously, the people that do take part become well known as the series progresses and as each day progresses, and some of them, you know, have entered the popular lexicon. You know, it's kind of great heroes of our time. As rich as the sort of element of public service that this program does, you must rub your hands together as TV people, knowing that you've got a wonderful doctor, a fantastically charming nurse, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? This stuff is just good television, and that presumably is the point of it as well, John.
I think We make things because we want people to watch them. In somewhere like A&E, the sort of overriding feeling is that you want to be able to tell these incredible stories that do unfold, and that can sometimes be through the eyes of those medics who do an incredible job, you know, on a daily basis, saving people's lives and, you know, looking after and giving people great care. So where there are those people who do, for whatever reason, consent, the staff at the hospital, there are those who quite like being involved in the programme. You know, I think they take a huge amount of pride in what they do, and they want to show what they do, and you can tell, you know, there's that those people in the programs do, they are the people who return, and they are the people that we kind of, you know, go back to and do interviews with, because they've got a really interesting take. You know, at the same time, there are some of the staff who don't really want to be in it very much, or, you know, just want to be in it occasionally, and again, that's absolutely fine. But I think the important thing for us is to make sure that what we see unfolding in the A&E department is spoken through, given context by the medics who are there, because without that it wouldn't be the series that it is at all.
All the patients you're about to see were treated in just one 24-hour period.
You don't know how lucky I am to be talking to you right now.
We see situations where someone's life has just been turned upside down. People always try and remember what the last conversation was, or the last words that person said to them. And I suppose it's so much nicer if the words that they remember are, "I love you."
That was Hamo Forsyth and John Douglas, executive producer and series director for 24 Hours in A&E, made by The Garden Productions and broadcast on Channel 4 here in the UK. Medical dramas are popular fodder for viewers around the world, using hospitals as the backdrop to personal, character-driven stories. In New Zealand, Shortland Street has been gracing TV screens for more than 20 years, and it takes medical content seriously. But how do the actors and writers get it right? The show has three medical advisors on staff. One advises the storylines, another scripts, and another with on-set details, like how to inject a patient realistically. All work part-time as actual nurses in hospitals. Our reporter Anna Pearson met Alison James, a trained nurse who's been working with Shortland Street for a couple of years, advising writers on all things medical. She also works on set with actors from time to time, a job which involves fake blood, pretend CPR, and wait for it, slicing pigskin.
So I work with the writers, helping them come up with medical story and filling in detail when they sort of think someone's doing something medical in the background, and I write in what that is. And then I also do on-set work where I help them film, making sure that they're saying words correctly and that their stethoscopes are on the right way and all that sort of detail of, you know, dressing patients in the background, making them look like they're in hospital, that kind of thing. And occasionally I see things and I think, oh, you know, I miss that suction not being plugged in the background, but then I think I'm probably the only person that's going to notice that. There's a couple of things that I'm really a stickler on getting right. So CPR is one of those things. There's actually been studies to show that people remember how to do CPR only having seen it in medical shows. And there's been a couple of instances in New Zealand where people have ended up saving people's lives because of CPR they've seen on Shortland Street. That's great. And obviously, if you can do that kind of education through this sort of medium, it's really awesome. When you're a nurse, you forget that you're exposed to these things all the time, but the general public aren't. And so it can be a really good way of doing things like, you know, general health education messages about smoking or about diabetes or about obesity and that kind of stuff. And for some people, that's their only interaction that they're going to have with a health world.
It's been over 20 minutes. Okay, that's enough.
Sam Bunkle is a tall, dark actor who plays Boyd Rolleston, a no-nonsense surgeon at Shortland Street Hospital. Sam's only experience of the medical system before this role was through having Legionnaire's disease in his 20s and visiting sick friends in hospital. Sam says the show's medical advisors help make sure the medical storylines are as accurate as possible in the realms of a soap opera. He described a recent scene involving spinal surgery.
So when you're doing sort of spinal surgery, they use all these quite fiddly screws and bolts and bits of metal, and so we had all this stuff, you know, sticking out all over the place, and you have like special tools. Like, it's quite interesting when you talk to the nurses about that kind of surgery where it's to do with bones and things. Like, it's actually quite rough. Like, you imagine surgery being quite delicate, but anything with bones is quite vicious, and, well, not vicious, sorry, that's the wrong word, but just like uses quite a lot of strength and is quite a lot rougher than you think. So every time I'm doing it, sometimes we have to go again. They're like, no, shove it in there and give it a whack with the hammer, you know, things like that. If you wanted to get your surgery done by someone, you want it done by someone like Boyd, who's just like tunnel vision almost on getting this surgery absolutely perfect, can't mess anything up, got to play by the rules, got to, yeah, that's sort of where he's heading. He has been a bit of a maverick in the past, but now is more, yeah, playing by the rules. I have heard tales of people going into operations and they've seen so many operations go wrong on the show that they're like freaking out, you know, and it's sort of like, oh, that's really sad that we've kind of, I mean, you know, it's great for the drama of it, but if people are going into real life situations kind of a bit concerned, I think that's where it's important to get medical stuff right, and especially like if we're doing CPR and that's the only time people have seen CPR done. If in an emergency situation people were just pulling something out of their head, you know, better that it's something that's semi-accurate.
Sally Martin plays Nicole, a confident, happy nurse who spends her working life in scrubs. Sally says it's difficult to give fake CPR convincingly, something she had to do recently.
And it's probably the one thing on the show that I feel most nervous about, because you can't actually do it properly on anybody because you will likely break ribs or a sternum. You know, you have to be very fast and really strong. And so to sell it on another person, it's really difficult. I mean, there are so many people watching the show and it may be sort of foreign to us, but there are so many people that watch and know what they're doing. We don't often have, you don't see the wound necessarily, and if you do, we use a slab of pig skin, so not actually prosthetics. I think maybe if I wasn't an actor, I'd quite like to be a nurse. Funnily enough, nothing actually to do with the experience I've had on this show. I like the idea of helping people or being able to help people when they're in a crisis.
When she's not advising actors and writers, Alison James works as an actual nurse in an emergency department, and she says it's good to keep her hand in the medical world. I asked Alison about her experience working with fake blood and prosthetics on the Shortland Street set.
There's definitely some directors who prefer a lot of fake blood. It's really sticky and it gets on everything. And a lot of putting fake IVs onto people and you know, bandages and making people look like they've been in the wars in various ways. My main critics are my friends who still work in the medical field because they want to show the sort of more boring aspects of life, so that the shift work sort of stuff and, you know, and I mean, at the end of the day, it's a drama and, you know, we're not a documentary and people don't really want to watch a whole lot of nurses go on about how tired night shift makes them.
That was Alison James, a medical advisor to Shortland Street, one of New Zealand's most watched TV shows, and thanks to Anna Pearson for that report. Stick around, because after the break, we'll find out how hospital dramas go down in Southeast Asia.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong, or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and today we're pondering why do we love medical dramas. Our next story takes us to Cambodia. Just over 10 years ago, a hospital drama called Taste of Life was commissioned to help raise awareness of HIV. TV scriptwriter Matthew Bayliss headed to the Southeast Asian country for 2 years to work on the programme and to help locals train up in film production. So how do you write a Western-style hospital drama for an Eastern audience? Matthew came by Midori House to tell Holly.
Years ago, when I first came to London, I applied for a job on a children's soap opera that was on the BBC called Biker Grove. Some listeners might know it. And I didn't get that job, but I became friendly with the boss of that show, and later on, we both went to work on another big soap opera called EastEnders on BBC One. And then after that, we were invited to go to Cambodia to set up a drama series with the aim of both training people in making television and also spreading important health messages. So I went there as the storyliner and also to train the writers and to edit the scripts.
Did Cambodia have any medical dramas that you knew of before this?
No. Their sort of traditional fare, generally, was a lot of imported movies, often with having been subtitled by so many different countries in so many different languages that you couldn't actually see the screen, and sort of quite long, sort of mytho-poetic things that are made by sort of venerable old directors, including the former king of Cambodia. He made a couple of sort of six-hour epics, which were sort of based on Cambodian stories and feature princesses and flying cows and other sort of things like that. So really, they didn't have even a tradition of telling gritty kitchen sink drama at all in the way that we know it. So it was quite a different thing here.
So you were taking a Western style over to Cambodia. How different was it writing for a Cambodian audience when you're used to writing for a British audience?
It's one of those things that turns out to be sort of both alien and very familiar. In a sense, when you start building a soap opera, what you start with is characters, and you start with a group of friends or something like that. In our case, we started with some nurses who were training at the nursing college, and that brought them into contact with the hospital because they had to go to the hospital to do their training, and then allied them to a group of young doctors. In that sense, you know, young people, first jobs, dealing with parents, money, that kind of thing, the stories were absolutely the same. And also, you know, in that sense, the characters were the same. You know, you have a good-looking, serious young man, and you have a slightly less good-looking one who's a bit of a clown, and, you know, you have someone who's a terrible gossip, and you do all the sort of staples, and they work as well in every country because they are recognisable archetypes. But other things would sort of sometimes pull you up sharp. I mean, for instance, one of the biggest battles we had was over the issue of dubbing. They are very keen on having all their movies and TV shows overdubbed. So they don't have natural sound, they just have an added-on voiceover. And I think there's always a sense that, particularly when you're dealing with subjects that people might be consider to be a bit taboo, and one of the major reasons for our drama was to tackle HIV, I think quite often in some cultures there is a resistance that's based on a sense of pride to actually discussing the issues. So people would say, you know, at the early stages, even the writers and the directors and the cameramen would say, you know, we don't have this problem in Cambodia. It doesn't happen here. And you'd say, well, you know, I just went on a on a fact-finding mission, and I saw the brothels, and I've been in the hospital, and I've seen the people. And, they would say, no, this simply isn't true. And that was a difficulty that I perhaps hadn't anticipated in actually persuading people, to even the people making it, to be ready to talk about it.
The aim behind this was to raise awareness of HIV. Did you find that it had an effect after the show went out?
You'd need to consult the lengthy research papers that the BBC compiled, but I know it's certainly considered to not be as much of a crisis issue as it was at the time we were sent out there, certainly. And certainly the rates amongst young men, who are our target group, have certainly dropped, yeah.
And how closely did you have to work with medical advisors on set?
We worked very closely. We had a sort of a partnership deal with the Department for International Development, as it was called then, and also UNICEF. And we had sort of on call the services of various people who work within those organisations who were medically trained and could tell us, you know, everything we sort of needed to know about those issues. So every time I came up with an issue in a script, I could sort of simply ring and have a chat and work out how to do it in a way that was accurate.
You get hospital dramas all over the world, whatever country you're in, a lot of them have a hospital drama that everyone watches. What do you think the enduring international appeal of a hospital drama is?
From an industry point of view, they're absolutely brilliant. They generate dozens and dozens of ever-changing stories. They're a very, very useful way of having a relatively cheap setup, then bringing lots and lots of different stories in. So it works very, very well from the point of view of people who make television. I think from the point of view of the audiences as well, you just sort of nothing really encompasses the life and death struggle of life itself more than a hospital where people either live or die.
And you said that when you were out there, you were training up Cambodians to how to edit scripts and things. Do you know if afterwards they carried this on, and has it become a bit more of a booming industry there since you went over and helped them?
That's very much the case. In fact, my former boss stayed on. Sometimes on rainy days like today, I wish I'd taken up his offer and stayed on too. But he stayed out there, and he set up an independent television and film company, staffed, you know, apart from him, almost entirely by young Cambodians who are now, yes, absolutely making a big waves in the industry.
That was Matthew Bayliss, scriptwriter for Taste of Life, the Cambodian medical drama, bringing us to the end of a show in which we attempted to answer the question, why do we love medical dramas? Well, it seems that despite the broken limbs and blood and guts, people like watching people help each other. Viewers also are fascinated by procedure and by story arcs that really could happen to them. All of human life, from triumph to tragedy and from birth to death, are the meat and potatoes of medical dramas, whether they're a groundbreaking documentary like 24 Hours in A&E or the turbocharged fiction of ER. And we need heroes, so much better if they're also healers. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly the Surgeon Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.